Folks, what I'm going to do now is just turn to some of your questions. We have a number of questions here, and I would love to hear more questions from you, and I will go for another 45 minutes, 50 minutes or so. Our friend RW has written in with $25. Thank you. And his question is, as a white nationalist, what are your opinions on psychotherapy and psychiatry in general? Well, that's an interesting question. I don't know if I'm answering this as a white nationalist per se, but just as a human being, I'm answering it. So what do I think of these things? Well, let me just state that if you or anybody out there is feeling really depressed or something, don't wait for me to say something encouraging. Call a professional and get some help, okay? Beyond that, over the years, I've had a real transformation in my thinking about this. I used to really strongly believe in what you can call cognitive therapy, rational emotive psychology, that a lot of times people's psychological suffering, it was based on false beliefs, false premises, and that these could be articulated and that they could be criticized and that they could slowly be replaced. And therefore, a kind of talk therapy was really an effective thing. And it might be still that way in terms of some things. But the truth is that the real things that people, the things that people really suffer badly from, depression and delusional thinking patterns, I don't think that you can deal with that with talk therapy. I honestly do think that you should simply seek psychoactive drugs, antidepressants, whatever, to deal with that. And yet, it's not all there is to it, because there was a psychiatrist that I met years ago whose basic position was, if you want to talk to somebody about your problems, talk to a priest or a bartender. You can't talk to me about it, because there's no clinical evidence that talk therapy makes people better if they're suffering from things like extreme depression and anxiety problems. So he would simply dispense these drugs. However, he said that it's not just a chemical thing, because there are several kinds of people that the drugs would not work on. And these people were the unemployed, the retired, and I guess a third category would be the independently wealthy people who are retired in another sense. And the thing that they all had in common is that they were free from having obligations that they had to meet to other people on a regular daily basis. So if you were a wealthy person, a person with no children to take care of, a person with no job to do, a person who was retired, the nest was empty, and you were depressed or anxious, you could take antidepressants, but chances are they weren't going to work. And therefore, something else needed to be added. And that really is simply having a mission in life, and a mission beyond simply satisfying yourself. And I think that that's a very, very interesting discovery. And it's something that I've been pondering for a long time. So I do believe that if you've got psychiatric issues, you should talk to a doctor and get things prescribed, because I do believe that talk therapy doesn't work with most problems. However, drug therapy doesn't work on its own either if you are not living in a particular kind of way. And the particular kind of way that seems to be conducive to mental health is to have obligations to others, not simply to yourself, and to be regularly meeting obligations to other people. So for what it's worth, those are my thoughts on it. I have a long-standing interest in theories of the soul. Plato, at the core of Plato's Republic, is a theory of the soul. So philosophy and psychology overlap, and philosophy and psychiatry overlap as well, because philosophers talk about the maladies of the soul, things like vices, for instance. So it's been a long-standing interest of mine, and I've read a vast amount of this literature over the years, Freud and Jung and many other thinkers. But I have come to the conclusion, based on dealing with people who are having severe psychiatric problems, that there was nothing I could say to help them, and that they simply had, in some cases, to be hospitalized and put on medication. So don't disdain that. There are a lot of people who have a sort of humanistic or spiritual orientation who believe that there's something wrong with that. And they think that if they have a malady of the soul, that you can't fix it with a physical thing like a pill. That's not true. People have a lot of moral attitudes that get in the way of them taking medications for psychic maladies, and those should be abandoned. There are people who say, I don't want to take something that I'll become dependent upon. Well, if you have diabetes, you're going to be dependent upon insulin. There are certain chronic conditions that you need chronic treatment for. And it's not an addiction. It's not a moral failing. It's not a sin, as some people seem to think, to seek out those sorts of solutions. So I have another super chat here from our friend Clarissa, who sends $25, but there's no question. And I'm looking at the other questions here, and I realize that a lot of those questions were answered last week, the earlier ones, by Millennial Woes. They go back to his stream. So folks, if you are listening and you have questions and discussions, topics for discussion, let me know. I'm happy to answer these things. So somebody says psychology is a pseudoscience, mostly a scam. I don't think so. I don't know why people believe that. I believe that there are certain psychological theories that have been put forward that don't seem to be true, and they have been largely discarded. Why? Because psychology is a science. You can apply a scientific method to the study of the soul. Now, if you have a religious idea that the soul is somehow infinite and ineffable or whatever, I can see why people have views like that. But the truth is that you can have scientific studies of the soul. And pseudoscientific theories are displaced by more scientific theories because psychology and also psychiatry really are scientific. You can apply scientific method to these things. And I do think that they have made progress over time, which is something that you would expect from a genuine science. Genuine science is a cumulative, progressive endeavor. We know more about mathematics now than we did at the time of Euclid. And a college student can know things about mathematics that were only discoverable in the past by geniuses. A slightly above average college student can now know how to do calculus, whereas it took great geniuses like Leibniz and Newton to create it in the first place. So there is something cumulative and progressive about science, and it moves forward by coming up with theories about unexplained phenomena, finding ways of testing them, discarding the ones that simply can't make it, that don't survive testing, and building on the ones that do. So that is, I think, the model of a science. Now, there's certain aspects of psychology that you could say are more speculative. Certainly, there's a lot of stuff in Jung and Freud that's speculative, that's not, I would say, scientific. But I still think that within the mainstream of what's called psychology, there's definitely the application of scientific method to the study of the soul. So Archie writes in, remember the scene in Midnight Express about Billy Hayes? The prisoners were walking in a circle in the prison, and the man told Billy that he's a broken machine. The thing about being dependent on a pharmaceutical is that you're trapped in a city, can't live in the woods. Well, this is true, but this is true of a lot of things. Before modernity, a lot of us would have died because we got sick and there weren't medications. And that means that a lot of us would die if, in effect, we left the modern world and went out to live in the woods. All told, though, I think that it's not a bad deal unless you really want to just leave the modern world behind. But I think you're going to discover a whole lot of other dependencies besides just needing a particular pharmaceutical. Chuck writes in, it's not about the individual. It's all about others also. We're in this together. Doing good for others feels great. I honestly think that that's true. And I think that this is what this psychiatrist was saying, that maybe a lot of people's maladies simply come from being entirely oriented towards self-gratification. Beyond that, I do think that freedom from necessity is sometimes debilitating for people. There's a wonderful book by Joseph Pieper called Leisure, the Basis of Culture, where he argues that, yes, freedom from material necessity is a condition for the creation of high culture. This is something that you got from Aristotle, for instance. Aristotle's Metaphysics talks about this. This was understood widely by the ancients. However, I have come to think that work is not such a bad thing. And one view that I've defended over the years that may not actually survive testing by reality is the idea that a universal basic income would be a good thing for people. Now, there are all kinds of economic arguments for why a universal basic income would be a good thing to create liquidity, basically. However, we would have to deal with serious psychological problems, because in today's culture, where a shocking number of people basically are dominated by work, and beyond that, sadly, the healthiest thing in a lot of people's lives are their jobs, even if their jobs are not particularly interesting. They're still working with people, maintaining a schedule, meeting obligations, and so forth. I think these things are absolutely crucial for psychological health, such that if you no longer have to do these things, it's often psychologically very damaging. Now, people who retire, some of them get involved in volunteer work, things like that. And these are healthy things to do. But it's sort of up to the individual at that point, right? If you're retired, you've got a pension, you don't need to work, you don't need to leave your house, right? If you decide, okay, my life needs more meaningful obligations, you can go out and do that, but there's nothing pressuring you to do that like there was a job, the necessity of work. And a lot of people, therefore, will not do it. And a lot of people will, therefore, lapse into, well, depression, self-indulgence, an empty form of life, nihilism. Which means that if we had a universal basic income and a lot of people were liberated from the necessity of work, we would have to have something else in place, something else that's imposed upon them, lest their freedom from necessity make them miserable. We would need a culture that is very strongly affirmative of having obligations to others, being involved in society, and so forth. We would have to have some kind of very normative, intrusive, illiberal culture. Otherwise, plenty and freedom and lack of necessity is just going to be profoundly corrupting. I guess the answer to this is that if you have a universal basic income in a basically liberal individualist society where the meaning of life is just wrapped up with self-gratification, you're actually going to make people very miserable. You have to have some other kind of society that doesn't allow people to simply fall into that kind of mouse utopia, that life of plenty and self-gratification that's basically spiritually deadening. Let's see if we have some more questions and comments here. So Danny writes in with $5. Thank you. I have two questions. What is your perspective on European Federalists and their scheme to incorporate Ukraine into the EU? And two, if Germany were to become nationalistic, what type of foreign policy would you recommend? Well, first of all, the question about Europe Federalists. Let's just take that term, Euro-Federalists, and put it in brackets and set it aside, because I don't know what that entails. I know on X, where I'm banned and I'm not even bothering to lurk anymore, there's a whole bunch of accounts that are Euro-Federalist, and the impression that I had when I was on X is that these people are up to no good. I don't know what their game is, but they're up to no good. Basically, they're trying to sell the European Union as is, which is an anti-white, ethnocidal, anti-European institution. They're trying to sell that to people as based. It's basically an attempt to sell people who are inclined, young people, who are inclined to be skeptical of EU-style libtardery, you know, continent-wide libtardery. People who might be skeptical of that are being sold this bill of goods by, I don't know, images of Napoleon, right? Trying to make it seem based. And that's a psyop. I don't know who's funding that psyop, but we should all be aware of that. Now, let's just set that aside. What about the idea of bringing Ukraine into the EU? All for it. I'm totally for bringing Ukraine into the EU. Why? Ukraine is part of Europe. Ukraine wants to be part of the EU. This horrible war goes back to 2013, when Ukraine was moving in the direction of EU integration, and then this traitor on the Russian payroll, who was their president, Yanukovych, abruptly reversed course after basically lots of money was deposited into his accounts by Putin. And of course, there were economic sanctions and things like that being threatened by Russia. And that was the beginning of the Maidan eventually and Yanukovych's ouster, because the majority of Ukrainians want to be part of Europe. They do not want to be part of Eurasia. They don't want any Mongol-style despotism. They don't want to be like Moscow. So I totally sympathize with that. And I think it would be good for Europe to have Ukraine in it. Why? Because Ukraine would be a natural conservative state. There's a large number of Ukrainians. They tend to be based. Even ones who think of themselves as liberal have very sensible attitudes. This is true in countries like Poland and Hungary as well. So if Ukraine became part of EU. The libtards would rapidly regret that because it would pull the EU in a sensibly conservative direction. I think that's an important thing. Another thing that it would do is solve some of the petty nationalist and ethnic squabbling problems that motivate countries like, say, or certain people in countries like Romania and Hungary to have negative attitudes towards Ukraine. Why would it do that? Well, if Ukraine became part of the EU, then all the same human rights laws would apply there as well. The reason why the Hungarians are not up in arms about Hungarians in Transylvania or Hungarians in Slovakia is because as minorities in EU countries, their rights are protected. And if Ukraine became part of the EU, then the rights of the Hungarian minority in Ukraine would be protected. The rights of Romanians in Ukraine or Poles in Ukraine would all be protected. And therefore, one small bone of contention would be removed. And it's not a serious bone of contention, but it is something that is easily used by Russia to basically create bad feelings between countries like Ukraine and neighbors like Poland or Hungary or Romania. So that would be a good thing. There are all kinds of laws that the EU has that are genuinely good at eliminating corruption and nepotism. And Ukraine is rife with corruption. And it would be good for Ukrainians to get some of that corruption out of their system. This is one of the reasons why a lot of ordinary Ukrainians would love to be part of the EU, because they see it as a less corrupt and more efficient society. So I think it would be a good thing for the EU, and I think it would be a good thing for Ukraine. And so I'm all for it. And the fact that Putin didn't want this is the reason why there's this war going on. And this war has been basically going on since 2014. So more than a decade. So that's a good question. So let me go to your second question. If Germany were to become nationalistic, what type of foreign policy would you recommend? Well, I would recommend that the Germans... Okay, this is a very important question. Because honestly, I would like the Germans to be more proud of themselves. An Austrian friend of mine, Martin Lichtmetz, told me about how the Austrians of old had this term of abuse for the Germans. It was a proper name, something like Piefke. But anyway, it simply referred to uptight and arrogant Germans. This was the, whereas the Austrians were more easygoing, right? And the Germans, especially, you know, I imagine Prussians under the Second Reich, the stereotype in Austria was that they were stuck up and arrogant people. And Martin said, you know, I wish we could bring those people back. Whatever happened to those Germans? I would love to see Germans have a reputation for being something other than Europe's most ethno-masochistic and self-loathing people. And I thought that was a brilliant point. I really loved that. So I want the Germans to be proud of themselves. But as soon as that happens, their neighbors start worrying, because Germany is the most powerful country in Europe. And therefore, they start worrying about things like borders and stuff like that. However, I think Germany becoming nationalist within the framework of the EU would probably be a good thing. But the thing that I really think would be the most damaging is for them to start getting revisionist about post-World War II borders. Why? Because it's just the beginning of the next European war. And I do think that bygones simply need to be bygones, and we need to move forward from that. So the foreign policy of a nationalistic Germany should be basically to strengthen Europe. And the present EU is a bad thing, but if it could be replaced by a better EU that's not run by anti-European bureaucrats, that would be a good thing. I think that what Europe really needs is just a mutual defense pact. Europe needs solidarity. Europe basically needs the attitude that if one of us is attacked, we all come back at you in block. That will keep the peace for Europe. So NATO without America, America seems to be fouling the nest anyway and on its way out. I would like to see the EU and its bureaucracy mostly gone. I would like to see a European-wide defense pact where all European countries pledge solidarity to one another, the biggest and the smallest, so they all work together as a block. I thought the reaction throughout most of Europe to the Ukraine war was extremely inspiring in that direction, because the tendency of most Europeans was horror that war has returned to Mother Europe and wanting to have solidarity. So I would like to see Germany have nationalist policies. I would like to see those policies expressed in foreign policy terms, in terms of pan-European solidarity and Europe as a civilizational bloc that has borders against the outside world that cannot be pushed around by the outside world. That would include Russia, because Russia is a different thing than a European country. It's a Eurasian mixed race, and I think civilizationally different society. And the United States, again, a European at its core, but it's a mixed race and I think civilizationally distinct society with incompatible interests from Europe. I would like Europe to be able to defend itself from Russia, from the United States, and from the global South all on its own. And I think a new version of NATO and a Germany that's given up on self-hatred would be necessary to make that happen. Because Germany is going to be the most powerful country in Europe, whether it hates itself or whether it's proud of itself. I would rather the Germans be proud of themselves and good neighbors and think of themselves as part of a greater European civilizational bloc. So let's see if we have any more questions here. Aaron writes in with $20. Thank you very much. Greg, your thoughts on the proposed implementation of a global digital currency by 2030. Who's proposing that? Who would implement that? I think it's a terrible idea, and I don't think people would actually do it. Who would control this currency? The control over currencies is one of the major levers of power by governments. And I do not anticipate these governments giving up their power to other governments or some NGO. Just like it didn't work to get all these sovereign nations to give up their sovereignty to something like the UN. In the end, they're going to hold on to their currencies because for the same reason they hold on to their sovereignty. Giving up a currency and going to some global uniform digital currency is a loss of sovereignty, and I don't think most countries will accept that. But that's an interesting question. I don't know who's proposing that. Is this the latest from the World Economic Forum or something like that? Let's see if there's some questions and comments in the chat here. Yes, there are several things here. Alice says hello from rural England. Hello back to you. I love rural England. I think it's a beautiful place. Rural England for the English. Archie writes, is there growing evidence that there is a relationship between neuroscience and political affiliation? Absolutely. Neuroscience is revealing that there are correlations between your political affiliation and other things that neuroscience can discover. That's true. There's a very fine-grained determinism at work in the human race, which is humiliating to people like me who tend to believe that we make our own way in this world. Yeah, I tend to think that I make up my own mind and think the way I think and have free will. But when you see this fine-grained determinism that is being discovered through genetics and psychology, it's kind of humiliating to that. Mr. Roboto writes in, worked in a pharmacy. It was a common occurrence for a customer to retire and go on vacation, get on a plane, have a heart attack, and die on the flight. That's fascinating. Archie writes, the ultimate love is dying for your nation, never mind just for your children. These days, there's little nation to die for. Just before last Christmas, Tucker talked with Rupert Lowe about Brits not being willing to die in a war for Britain. Lowe seemed only to allude to disloyal elites. Canada, he also adds, Canada has introduced weed, soma, in preparation for indolence due to mass unemployment. Yeah, well, you can only drug people so much. So yeah, I think there's going to be serious psychological consequences to AI. If AI brings about a utopia where everyone's put out of work by machines and basically gets on welfare or becomes part of the dividend class, right? It's actually not going to be psychologically healthy given the nature and value system of liberal societies. And Danny Vipont writes in, I've noticed there's a lot of odd stereotyping of Ukrainians in German circles. You see people who don't write like Germans, wrong use of definite, indefinite articles for a native German speaker, describing Ukrainians as the same as Russians. It seems psyop. Well, yeah, and if they're not using their articles correctly, it's probably a Russian psyop. It's a Slavic psyop, and which of the Slavic countries has an axe to grind against Ukraine? The biggest axe grinding country is the one currently invading Ukraine, which is Russia. And as we know, there's a vast amount of Russian disinformation and propaganda being pumped out about Ukraine. So that's important. And Danny says, which isn't to say that ethnic Russians and Ukrainians aren't very closely related Slavic peoples, but they do have their differences, and I think the Russians wish to downplay their differences so as to assimilate the Ukrainians. Yes, people talk about, oh, it's a brother war. Well, the truth is that they're not the same people. They might be closely related. Serbs and Croats are closely related. The Irish and the English are closely related. That hasn't stopped them from fighting each other, and it therefore doesn't change the fact that the best solution when two very closely related peoples hate each other is to just let them have their own countries, go their separate ways, which of course Russia is trying to deny. And one of the major central points of Russian propaganda on Ukraine is to deny that Ukrainians even exist. It sort of sounds like Jews denying that Palestinians even exist. There are no Palestinians, they say. It was a land without a people, namely there were no Palestinians. And Russians say there are no Ukrainians, and the people who think that they are Ukrainians just suffer from false consciousness. And they'll even go to amusing extents to argue that actually Ukrainians are just victims of a psyop going back to the Austro-Hungarian Empire. You see, it was the evil Austro-Hungarian Empire plotting against poor, innocent victim, the perpetual victim, Mother Russia, plotting against Mother Russia by convincing these Ukrainians that they were actually a different people from the Russians. So this is just an Austro-Hungarian psyop, Goy. That's it. I think that's ludicrous. And if people thinks they're a different people, then that's good enough for me. If you think you're a different people, you are a different people. Yeah, I do believe in the complete social construction of society. Yes, society is a social construct. If you think that you belong to a particular group of people and you're not just deluded, right? You're not like, if you're not a guy who thinks he's Napoleon, right? And therefore thinks he's Corsican. But if you actually grow up in a society and speak the language and feel attached to it and think that you belong to that society, that's basically it. Now, of course, that sounds like civic nationalism, I suppose, right? Surely there are Black people who think that they're British, okay? But there's a definite element of social construction to society. I would say that a Ukrainian has to be a white person, okay? But if a white person thinks that they belong to the Ukrainian nation, and again, they're not suffering from some mental illness, but that's just how they grew up. That's their identity. I would say that's evidence enough that they belong to the Ukrainian nation. And to say that, oh, it's mere false consciousness. No, it's just consciousness, right? They're not Russians who are just mistaken or have been deluded or have been psyoped. They're a different people. So Archie writes in, is Hungary's new government going to give up its domestic currency to replace it with the euro? There's been some talk of that. Honestly, I don't think it's going to happen. I don't think it's going to happen for two reasons. Okay. First of all, it would be bad for the Hungarian economy to be on the euro. Why? Well, because Hungary's economy is very much like Portugal's economy, or Spain's economy, or Italy's economy, or Greece's economy. Namely, they have a large agricultural export sector and a huge amount of tourism. Now, they do have more industry coming into Hungary, but the general profile of a country that has a large amount of agricultural exports and a huge tourist sector is that they benefit from having a weak currency. And the forint is a weak currency. And when South Europe, Portugal and Spain and Greece and Italy went on the euro, got rid of their soft currencies, that was not good for those countries. And I don't think it would be good for Hungary either. It would also be a loss of sovereignty, monetary sovereignty, which is a kind of sovereignty. And it would have to go through the Hungarian parliament. And I just don't think that Hungarians who think this through are going to be terribly encouraged to do this. They're not going to be enthusiastic about it. And that means that it just might not get through the parliament, even though the new Tisza party has a 2/3 majority. A lot of people in Tisza probably would think this through and think, nah, it doesn't make any sense. And one of the things that's very clear about this newly elected Prime Minister, Péter Magyar, is that he's actually more nationalistic and sovereigntist and quote-unquote based than a lot of people thought he was. A lot of the leftists who were celebrating, the Hillary Clintons who were celebrating, they're all very disappointed in him now. Ursula von der Leyen, I think, is very disappointed in Péter Magyar. And I think that the euro idea is just probably not going to go anywhere in Hungary. Those are my thoughts. I might be totally wrong. I don't think it's a very high priority for the Hungarians, one way or the other. I think that when they think about it, they're going to have the attitude, it's not really broke, so don't fix it. The things that are wrong with the Hungarian economy are not due to monetary sovereignty, put it that way. Yes, Archie points out that Péter Magyar has said that he would arrest Netanyahu if he showed up in Budapest. I thought that was extremely funny and interesting. So in 2024, Netanyahu was indicted as a war criminal by the International Criminal Court. Now, Hungary was a member of the ICC, and Orban decided to suck up a little bit more, because he could always do a little more sucking up to Netanyahu. You can never suck up to Netanyahu enough, apparently, if you're on the center right, decided, well, Hungary is going to exit that court, and therefore they were not going to execute the arrest warrant for Netanyahu if he shows up in Hungarian territory. And then, just to rub the world's nose in this, actually, in 2025, he rolled out the red carpet and invited Netanyahu to visit. This is a rather distasteful thing, even for Hungarians who are pro-Jewish. If they're not Jews, they're still Hungarians first. And seeing this kind of sycophancy, for fawning sycophancy for a war criminal, was a bit much. They didn't like that. And Magyar Péter, he's decided on putting Hungary back in the ICC, which means that if Netanyahu sets foot in Hungary, they will execute the arrest warrant for war crimes. Now, this came up in a press conference because Magyar was basically talking about inviting all these heads of government and heads of state from around the world to Budapest this fall to celebrate the 70th anniversary of the 1956 uprising. Well, if Netanyahu happens to be the leader of Israel this fall and accepts that invitation, the Hungarians would be in the awkward position of having to arrest a guy they invited to their country. So it's an interesting diplomatic problem. And it's really only a problem, though, because they basically are inviting the head of state of that country, but they can't really allow it if Netanyahu happens to be the head of state or head of government in Israel. They would invite him and then have to arrest him. It would be a bit of a snafu. So anyway, this was discussed in a press conference, and the reaction to it, I think, is quite funny. So yes, Hungary's incoming prime minister will arrest Netanyahu if he sets foot in Hungary. And I think Hungarians are pretty much fine with that. It's quite funny. Fawning over Israeli war criminals is really just a kind of MAGA thing at this point. Orbán's out, and so I think Europe's last guy to fawn over Netanyahu is out of office. It's really just America versus the whole rest of the world, and maybe a couple of tiny little countries that are somehow on America's dole, you know, some Polynesian islet that like Palau or something. They might be fine with Netanyahu, but basically the rest of the world sees him as a war criminal. I'm just going to check entropy. I think the SPLC indictment is a great thing. I think that they're probably guilty of far more crimes than wire fraud and banking fraud, but this is a good start. It's a good start to haul them into court. They were paying people basically to commit crimes, and I think that that is going to unravel them. I hope that the institution is basically destroyed. Their credibility should be dead at this point, and the institution itself might be destroyed because of this. And I'm very happy that this has happened. This investigation started in the first Trump administration. It was shut down under Biden. No surprise there. Revived under Trump again, and is now coming to fruition. The SPLC has been a bane in my life. It has been a bane to the broader white nationalist movement. And I hope that they go down in flames, and that some of the people who are involved in this, suborning crimes, basically, and engaged in corruption. I want them to be RICO'd. I want the whole damn lot of these people to be recoded. And I want Heidi Beirich and I want Mark Potok because they were involved. They've left the group, but I want them. I want them all dragged in. I want them under oath. I want them testifying. I want Mark Potok under oath, being asked questions about why he was keeping track of white population decline. I want to see that. I want to see get that all on record. And then there are a lot of people who suffered serious damages because of the work of the SPLC, the doxing work of the SPLC. I hope that these people can start coming forward and getting damages. I would like to see these infiltrators go to jail because they were criminals. I want our movement to be purged of people like this. And it would be great to discourage further infiltrators and traitors if some of these people actually go to jail. They should be shunned. They should be embarrassed. But they should also go to jail because some of them were engaged in criminal activity. And again, if you can just recode them all, they're all conspirators. I would love to see whoever that former chairman of the National Alliance is, who is on the take from the SPLC. I'd like to see him and Heidi Beirich and Mark Potok and all these people all go to jail eventually. That's a beautiful vision of what's going to happen. And yes, they were paying people to FedPost, literally. They were not just paying informants. They were paying people to commit crimes, and they were also shaping the messaging and planning events. So given that they were an anti-hate group that basically raised money from hate, scary haters out there. Given that they were raising money from scary haters, of course, what kind of messaging are they shaping? Scary hate. What kind of events would they be planning? Photogenic, scary hate events, right? It's fraud. There was not enough scary hate going on in America for the SPLC. They had ravenous fundraising agendas. So in order to slake their greed for donations, they had to increase the amount of scary hate out there. And then they would run to their donors and say, look at this scary hate. We have to fight this. Okay, that's just fraud. It's complete fraud. Beyond that, though, what's going on here is there's a symbiosis between certain people on the right and their haters, the ADL, the mainstream media, stuff like that. And this is just an instance of that broader symbiosis. I wrote a piece back, I think, in 2017 called In Bed with the Press. It's a review of a book by Vegas Tenold on... Basically, he was following around Richard Spencer and Matt Heimbach. And it just became clear to me reading this book that what was going on with Heimbach and Spencer is they were operating on the assumption that if the SPLC and the mainstream media were describing you as a leader, of the far right, as a leader of the hate group, hate movement, right? That people on the right, people in the movement, would think that you really are a leader. In effect, they believed that the people in our movement are so stupid that they would allow their enemies to pick their leaders for them. So, if you want the enemy to pick you as a leader, what do? Well, you lean in to the negative stereotypes of racist white people that the enemy deals in. So what are the hateful anti-white stereotypes that they deal in? Well, Richard Spencer played the villainous wasp snob, right? The fratty, villainous wasp snob. And Matt Heimbach played the fat, disheveled, grouty redneck, right? Matt Heimbach comes from an upper middle class family. He was, I'm sure, you know, he was genuinely fat. He wasn't pretending to be fat, but he was playing a certain lower class stereotype, the fat hillbilly stereotype. And by leaning into that, he was given attention by our enemies. And because he was getting attention by our enemies, there were certain people in our broader movement who thought, this guy is a leader. I hope not many, but their assumption, their operating assumption, was that if they would play this role and get talked about by our enemies, that they would thereby become leaders in our movement. And this was explained to me years ago by Matt Parrott. I think it was 2012, 2013. And I was just disgusted by that, frankly. I was disgusted by the cynicism of that. But I do think that was the strategy for Heimbach, and I do think that was the strategy for Spencer. And Heimbach would speak to the SPLC way back when. And I have every reason to think that if there's one guy who was involved in the Unite the Right planning from, 2013 to 2023, who was on the take, Heimbach is a very natural candidate for that. He sort of fits. He was actively engaged in courting them, and they were courting him. And I think that it's perfectly possible that he was actually the guy. I don't know, but it's perfectly possible. I don't believe in, well, put it this way. I'm not going to say it's him or anybody else just based on speculation. The shoe does look like it fits in this case, but there's no need to speculate about this because this is going to go to trial and the names of all these informants and traitors will eventually come out in the trial. I have no doubt about it. So I'm willing to just wait. I'm willing to wait and see, but he does really fit the bill. And I know that he was actively courting these people all the way back as early as 2013. So yeah, there's a symbiosis, and it turns out that the symbiosis was far more involved than just sort of, you know, feeding one another, right? You play into their stereotypes, they give you more press, you get more cred, you lean more into the stereotypes. There was actual money being exchanged in some cases. In one case, up to $1 million paid to a guy with the National Alliance. That's astonishing. What were they getting for all that? They had to be getting their money's worth. During the 10-year period that they are accused of paying out $3 million to people involved in these various hate groups, they raised more than $1 billion. So it was a very good investment. I'm very, very eager to learn the names of all these people. I really want to know what damage they did. I hope that there is a long list of people coming forward who have been damaged by them, who can pursue these people, pursue the SPLC, pursue their informants. If somebody got a cool $1 million from the SPLC by doxing people, and that's what was done, there are people who've suffered severe career and financial damages from that. I want them to go after that $1 million. Whoever it is, I want that guy to be cleaned out. Was this guy paying his taxes on that $1 million? That's another interesting question. I think these people are in for a world of hurt, and it couldn't happen to a nicer bunch. So let's see if there are any more questions here, and then I'm going to wrap up. Yeah, Spencer gives off Snidely Whiplash vibes. Exactly. Danny writes in, I was in my early teens when Spencer's group set up a Discord chat, Trump Turn One. And when I respectfully asked about goals, they basically told me to get lost. That was my first experience with internet-based WN groups. And then I joined a European forum, which helped me learn a lot. She also writes in, I get that I was super young and honestly couldn't have really contributed much, but it was obvious to me at the time that they weren't serious and didn't really want to grow or evolve. Absolutely. Wing IT Prod, is that it? Too bad Cash Patel is the face of these charges. Well, it's really Todd Blanche who's more the face of this. But Christ, Patel looks ghastly in the photo of that press conference. Is there something he's getting plenty of money. Can't he do something about those crossed eyes? He just looks like a mutant, just a brown mutant. He's not a very attractive face for anything. But yeah, folks, I think that's it. I don't see anything more here on entropy. I'm going to give it one more refresh just so I don't overlook anybody. We're done. Thank you again. And we will be back next week discussing this SPLC thing in greater detail with some lawyers, I hope. And in the meantime, just keep reading Countercurrents. Oh, wait. I'm sorry. Somebody just asked, Greg, what do you do to unwind and refresh from our movement? One more question. I'll answer that. What do I do to unwind and refresh from our movement? I like to read history or philosophy, but I really find that at the end of the day, when I'm actually unwinding, history is the best thing. And the histories that I've been reading recently are Plutarch's Lives, which is one of the great treasures of antiquity. And I've also been rereading, after decades, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire by Edward Gibbon. And I never read past volume 2. There are 6 volumes. I never read past volume 2. I'm now approaching the end of volume 2. And I think I'm just going to go and read the whole 6 volumes of it. Because it's just so fascinating. And by the end of volume 2, basically you get to the end of the Western Roman Empire. The next 4 volumes deal with the barbarian nations, with Byzantium, with Islam, all the way up to the end of the Byzantine Empire. But that's a lot of history that I'm going to read through. So I'm excited to do that. And then after I'm done with that, I think I'm going to go through John Pocock's Barbarism and Religion, which is his book on Gibbon. It is also 6 volumes long. And it's just basically an extraordinary intellectual history of Gibbon's sources and time. Basically, it's a context for understanding his history of Rome. So I think I'm going to be reading that. So I do like reading historical narratives. I'm going to continue reading Plutarch too. So that's how I unwind from our movement. Well, folks, that seems to be it. I want to thank all of you for tuning in. I want to thank Jared for giving us his time. I want to thank everyone who's super chatted. And we will be back next week. There's a whole bunch to discuss with the SPLC. And I'm going to try and get a panel together to talk about this. All right. Well, thank you so much. And we will be back next week. So keep reading Countercurrents and maybe pick up some Plutarch.